Now we're reading from Isaiah chapter 41. Isaiah 41. Some verses beginning at 10, verse 10. Isaiah 41, verse 10. The word of God reads, "Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee, yea, I will help thee, yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Behold, all they that were incensed against thee shall be ashamed and confounded. They shall be as nothing, and they that strive with thee shall perish. Thou shalt seek them, and shalt not find them, even them that contended with thee. They that war against thee shall be as nothing, and as a thing of naught. For I, the Lord thy God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, Fear not, I will help thee. Fear not, thou worm Jacob, and ye men of Israel. I will help thee, saith the Lord, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I will make thee a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth. Thou shalt thresh the mountains, and beat them small, and shalt make the hills as chaff. Thou shalt fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them. Thou shalt rejoice in the Lord, and shalt glory in the Holy One of Israel. When the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue faileth for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers in high places, and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water, and the dry land springs of water." In verse 17 there, we read about the poor and needy. And tonight we're going to be hearing about the poor and needy. In fact, we're going to be hearing about the very poor and the very needy. Here, of course, it is referring to the poor and needy spiritually. In the lecture tonight, we'll hear about the people who were very poor and very needy, both spiritually and physically. Well, the Lord bless his word to us. Once again, a man is seen running with all his might toward the police station. Arriving there, almost breathless, he gasps out, "Come, come, Black Ball is drunk and raging mad. Come quickly, or he will kill somebody." Five policemen instantly prepare themselves for what they know by experience will be a dangerous work. Snatching hold of a strong rope and the leg irons, they hurry away to the scene of the uproar. The moment Black Ball sees them, he raises his giant form, swings his arms, and threatens death to the first man who touches him. A signal is given, and the five policemen rush upon the monster. Hats roll on the ground, patches of coats, belts, white waistcoats, and shirts fly in the air. The struggle is fearful, but at last the terrible disturber of the peace lies writhing on the ground, roped, ironed, and gagged, and taken to the police station. Who is he? Well, it is Joseph Taylor, or Job Morley, or Black Ball, for he was known by all three names. Job Morley is the correct name. In his early days, he had a drunken father and a kind, loving mother who sometimes took him to the house of prayer. He copied the example, sadly, of his father, and became a reckless, wild young man. Idleness and drunkenness produced their usual fruit. Sooner than work, he became a gambler and a thief, and excelled in all manner of wickedness. He moved from place to place and changed his name, all to avoid the police. Some years later, John Ashworth writes, I was to preach at Batley in Yorkshire. After the service, a well-dressed man followed me into the schoolroom. He said, Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Job Morley, better known as Black Ball. I was a dealer in hens, cocks, pigeons, poll parrots, ferrets, white mice, guinea pigs, magpies, and monkeys. I have been the captain of 8 gangs of thieves. I have been a pest to the magistrates, a terror to the police, and a disgrace to humanity. Now I am a child of God, a sinner saved by grace, happy in the love of Christ, and today I have been saved 7 years. Then, diving his hand into his pocket, he pulled out 100 sovereigns, saying, Look here, sir, those are all bright teetotalers. They would have been in the public house if I had not been saved. Well, bless the Lord. Now, sir, I can hold up my head anywhere. I can also lift up my voice like a trumpet and tell sinners that Christ, having saved Black Ball, he can save to the uttermost. Bless his holy name. Well, Job Morley died in December 1871. Now is among the saints in glory, redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. Well, such were the types among whom Ashworth mixed, and such were the mighty works of saving grace which he witnessed. In his book, The Life of John Ashworth, A.L. Coleman writes in the preface, In order to keep to within the prescribed limit, much valuable matter is unavoidably left out, and the great difficulty has been in making a selection. Well, that's the same in this lecture. How much do we put in and how much do we leave out? There were 5 books that Ashworth wrote. This one was written about him, but there are 5 books that he has written, and they are nearly all pen pictures of people that he met and dealt with. And if you can read through those 5 books without weeping, then you're a remarkably hard character. He just dealt with the worst cases that there possibly could be because of his own circumstances. Well, now, what I'm going to do tonight really is emphasize on him personally rather than these characters who were saved, but there are some of those in the book which I trust, if you haven't got it, you will take it afterwards. Now, John Ashworth was born in Rochdale in Lancashire on the 8th of July, 1813. The area was notorious for the degrading amusements engaged in by the locals. Bull baits, cockfighting, dogfights, trail hunts, drinking and gambling had gone on for over half a century. The females of the community would engage in the same pursuits with as much enthusiasm as the men. Brought up in such an area, Ashworth was, in the kind providence of God, delivered from those dreadful entertainments, and he ascribed it in particular to 2 things, a pious praying mother and the Sunday school. I give some idea of his early circumstances. He writes, One day I was out playing and mother called me in. I took up my marbles and quietly followed her. She said, I am making you a pinafore out of a part of a wool sack. It will cover your ragged clothes and you will look a little better. This was a wool sack that would have come from one of the mills, you know, the factories. The quiet way in which she spoke and the sad look which accompanied her words subdued all my objections. Sunday morning came, and I was to have on my new pinafore to cover my patched garments. I shall never forget that new pinafore. The wool sheets had on them at that time, in large black letters, the word wool, so everybody would know where it had come from. My mother washed and washed and washed, but the word wool would not come out. I put my arms down the sleeves and was stretching the front when I saw the letters. My little spirit sank within me in bitter sorrow. I looked into my mother's face, but when I saw the tears in her eyes, I instantly said, "Never mind, mother, never mind. It will do well. It covers my patches. And when I get to school, I will sit on the letters and no one will see them. Do not cry, mother. We shall be better off yet." 50 years later, when the old chapel was taken down, when he says school, he means Sunday school. 50 years later, when the old chapel was taken down, he bought the pew in which he sat in his wool sheet pinafore. He kept it in his study and often knelt at it to remember all the way God had brought him since those early days. Some years after he had sat barefoot in his wool sheet pinafore, an event occurred in the same building. He tells the story. He writes, "It was the Sabbath evening. The congregation was very large, and they were waiting for the appearance of the preacher. He, poor man, was on his knees in the vestry, praying for divine help and trembling with fear. One of the deacons opened the vestry door, and the young preacher rose from his knees and ascended to the pulpit. There was an elderly female in the congregation whose face was covered with her hands and whose head was bowed in deep reverence. Large tears streamed down her pale face. That woman was my own dear mother, and the young, timid, trembling preacher was myself, once her little barefooted, ragged boy, her own dear child. We were in the same old sanctuary, she a weeping worshipper, and me her son, a sinner saved by grace, and now a preacher of the gospel." They were grievous days for young Ashworth, as some boys would sneer at his poverty. His Sunday school class must have looked a poor lot, but going back to the 15th century, a rather eccentric schoolmaster named John Trebonius had a profound reverence and respect for his scholars. He would say, "Who can tell what may rise up from among these youths?" And who can tell what may rise up tonight from among these youths that are in this congregation? Who knows? Who knows? Well, eccentric man, I never knew, of course, he lived in the 15th century, I'm not that old. "Who can tell what may rise up from among these youths who may guide the destinies of empires?" How little did the good man guess that sitting in that very classroom was a small boy by the name of Martin Luther. Also, the teachers at Ashworth's Sunday School little knew what energies were slumbering beneath that wool sheet pinafore. The little ragged, barefooted boy would yet exercise such an influence for the good of his fellow man. Very early in life, he acquired a taste for reading and would stand for hours in his bare feet reading to the other members of the family out of Fox's Book of Martyrs and Tales of the Covenanters, till they were all in tears. Those influences had such an effect upon his mind that they made him the unflinching opponent and antagonist of oppression and tyranny of every description, whether political, civil, or religious. The hand of God was on the boy, and he was being prepared for a great work. The family suffered even more by the way of poverty because of the drinking habits of John's father. There was a nearby wood where John would go to pray for his father that he would not drink any more and would not attend the public house, but would become a good father. After leaving home for work, he would return to visit once a fortnight. On one of those visits, he asked his mother where father was. On being told he was in the wood, he went in search of him, finding him not in a drunken stupor, as he expected, but bound in prayer. Without disturbing him, he ran home to tell his mother, and through her tears, his mother said, "Our prayers are heard at last, and my son, S-U-N, is now setting in a clear sky." John Ashworth's lifelong hatred of what he termed the accursed thing, alcohol, and his unflagging efforts in the cause of temperance may doubtless be attributed to the remembrance of what he suffered in consequence of his father drinking alcohol. Ashworth tells of how he fell in love. He tells it in such detail, he must have thought it important to have so recorded it. A new girl came to the village, and immediately he was infatuated with her. I know the feeling. But how could he get to her? Well, he wrote a letter. It was returned. Then he wrote another letter. That was also returned. Then he sent her a book. And that was returned. He almost despaired. Yet he guessed she did have some feelings for him. About the time, her father said, "Jane, there is a young man who walks past our door very often, though I imagine it is out of his way to do so. Therefore, I have felt some concern about you. Have you given him any encouragement?" "No, father." Later, I met her father, and he gave me liberty to call at their home the following Thursday evening. Thursday came, and 8 o'clock came. But how I got into that house, I can never tell. I did get in, however, and found the farmer sitting on one side of the fire, looking thoughtfully into it. The mother was near, darning stockings with a very white face, and Jane was beside her, sewing, with a very red face. None of them seemed to notice my entrance, so I took a seat as near to them as I dared, and we all sat and sat and sat in total silence, just like a Quaker meeting. At last the father began to ask a number of questions. "How old are you?" I told him. "Do you attend a place of worship?" "Yes, sir, I am a member of the church." "Do you ever go into a public house?" "No, sir, and I hope I never shall." "When you bring home your wages, how much do you give to your mother?" "I never keep one penny from my mother, for I could never give her enough." Again he was silent, and undoubtedly contending with his feelings, as I was anxiously awaiting his verdict. "Well, young man, I like your answers, and we think our daughter has done right in not encouraging you until we had a better knowledge of your character. But we are not blind to her thoughts. Respect yourself and respect my daughter. She is a good girl. Let everything be honourable between you, and may the God of her father and mother bless you both." The last sentence was said with a trembling, choking utterance, and amidst heavy sobs and heaving breasts from all present. Now, there are some who would make merry with the gravity of that night's interview, but to me, it was felt to be a serious matter. Births, marriages, and deaths are no trifles. My own parents approving of my choice, in due time we were married. The ceremony took place at Rochdale Parish Church in October 1832. I've seen that church in Rochdale where he was married, and also seen the place where he was born in Rochdale. My wife and I began the uphill journey together, but neither of us, before we set out, had any idea how steep our road was to be. Ashworth's employment was brought to a standstill when his employer's business failed. He was offered a shop and sold to customers on credit, but they failed to pay, and he had to give it up. He writes, "Oh, debt, debt, debt. Talk about nightmare. It is to the honest man nightmare and daymare. It has a depressing, crushing, paralyzing effect, and hangs like a dead weight on the mind. We were kept very poor, and the winter setting in, my wife and I were reduced to the greatest straits. I remember one Saturday, we had not one penny in the house, not one piece of bread. not one hatful of coal. Desperate days followed. One crisis came after another that are almost too painful to tell. Poverty was a daily, yes, hourly burden that they both had to carry. Well, there's a lot going on all about that which haven't time to go into. Well, time failed to tell of all the sorrowful situation that debt brought upon them. At long last, the day came when Ashworth paid off his last creditor. His joy knew no bounds. He determined not to put the signing off their debts into his pocket until his wife had seen it. He went home in abounding joy and thankfulness to God. But on entering the room where his wife was, he found her surrounded by three doctors. Their own doctor, who had been treating her, wanting further opinion, had brought in two others. Ashworth was greeted with the news that his wife's foot would have to be amputated or she would die. Mrs. Ashworth then began a prolonged period of illness that led to her death. Her husband writes, "She lived as a Christian and she died as a Christian. The rapturous felicity, the joys unspeakable of the last few weeks of her life can never be told. Anything more truly glorious I never saw, heard, or read of. A short time before breathing her last, she was very desirous of hearing her aged father pray once more before she died. Here is a dying child requesting in her last moments to hear once again the well-known, well-remembered voice which in her childhood she first heard in prayer. I went to tell the old man of his daughter's request. With quivering lips and swimming eyes, he put on his broad-brimmed hat, took hold of my arm, and in silence we walked on to witness the last sad scene. She received him with a smile. Poor man, how he loved his child. He tried to speak to her, but could not. He walked about the room, struggling with his feelings, but every time he turned toward the bed to look on the pale, sweet face of his only daughter, knowing that in a short time her bright eyes would be closed in death, he was overwhelmed. In this state, he knelt down. Knelt long ere he uttered a word. At last, utterance came. And oh, what a prayer! We rose from our knees in tears. But the dying one had no tears. She was too happy for that. Being on the verge of that place where no tears are shed, she smiled and said, "It sounds like old times, Father. Farewell." Two of their children died in infancy. The first, when about a year old, the second at 4 years, having been scalded. Their eldest son went to New Zealand and died in a drowning accident. The second son, after the death of his brother, also emigrated to New Zealand. Ashworth's only daughter, Mary Jane, with whom he enjoyed a very close attachment, died at 24 years of age. She is buried next to her father in Rochdale Cemetery. I've seen both of those graves and so moved when I just stood there looking at them. Ashworth, by his integrity, attention to business, and indomitable perseverance, ultimately succeeded in establishing a good business. He had quite extraordinary natural gifts, great mental powers, and a strong physical condition. The death of his eldest son in New Zealand was the affliction that saw him rise up as a man with a great commission. He must work for God, and that work would be amongst the lowest of the low. His experience of dire poverty he could never forget, and he would work to relieve all he could by carrying God's gospel to them and seeking to alleviate their suffering in every way he could. Believing that God would bless the undertaking, he determined not to consult any human being, but go at once to work, dependent on God's help and blessing. He got 2,000 leaflets printed. One Sunday morning, he says it was memorable, he took his leaflets and walked through the back streets and low places, and whenever he saw someone in rags and tatters, he would give them a leaflet and invite them to his chapel, new chapel. Not new building, but anyway, new chapel. He called it the chapel for the destitute. Can you imagine a chapel being called that? If your church was called the chapel for the destitute, you can guarantee there'd be no Pharisees there next Sunday morning. No, we call our churches by nice names, don't we? Anyway, he called his the chapel for the destitute. He continued his visiting to many. He went to lodging houses where the filth and degradation appalled him, but his love for people drove him on. His leaflet read, "Chapel for the Destitute, near the back steps, Bailey Street, Rochdale. Ye houseless, homeless, friendless outcasts, come. In rags and tatters, come. Ye poor and maimed and halt and blind, come. Of whatever colour or nation, creed or no creed, come. Jesus loves you and died to save you. Come then to him, all ye wretched, lost and ruined by the fall. If you wait until you're better, you will never come at all. No collections. All we seek is your welfare, body and soul. Service every Sunday at 6:15. Come, poor sinners, come and welcome." Well, after that, it's quite a story, which I can only give a summary here, but it's incredible. He writes, "Let me seek to describe some of the characters I was trying to induce to a place of worship. There was a dancing man, a man just dancing around the place, a flat-nosed man, and the singing woman, Jenny Lind, who sang in the streets and in the public houses. There was a man with a wooden leg, which he was there polishing furiously. There was a thin man with black hair, which he was trying to part, looking into a broken looking glass. Another man had a long beard and a dirty, ragged red slop for a shirt. Another had a pair of spectacles on his forehead and a grey-haired old woman for wife. Others there were of a similar mold. Wishing to get someone to volunteer, because of course hardly anybody could read, wishing to get someone to volunteer, I laid my hand on the shoulder of the thin man who was trying to part his hair, and I asked him, 'Can you read?' 'Yes, yes,' he said he could read. 'Well, will you stand and read and challenge this whole house?' So, displaying his literature abilities, he stood on a chair and he read the leaflet to the house. Well, there was a general shout from all that if I got him, I should get the worst of them all. They would like to see Bill Guest in a chapel. 'Yes,' said the wooden-legged man. 'If Bill goes, I go.' 'And me,' said the flat-nosed man. 'And me,' said the red slop. 'And me,' said Jenny Lind. Bill very coolly observed that they had better mind what they were doing and saying, or he might surprise some of them. But the whole 15 declared that they would go if he went. 'Then I go,' said Bill Guest. 'And now let me see which of you will show the white feather.' We bargained that I would call for them at 6 o'clock and show them the way." How to start a church. You know, we read, don't we, about founding a church. Well, "I went there. I went on from there to a number of idlers on the stone bridge. Whilst giving out my leaflets, a blustering, young, dirty, but well-dressed man wanted to know what it was all about. I gave him a leaflet. He said, 'Mr. Ashworth, look at me. Look at me. I am a man that deserves damnation if ever a man did. I am the unworthy son of the best of fathers and mothers. They set me a good example, but I got amongst wicked companions, have spent in cursed drink hundreds of pounds, wandered from home, and now I am a wretched outcast. I asked him to the meeting, and he said he would come. Well, it was now 5 o'clock, and in an hour and a quarter I should have to meet my first congregation in the chapel for the destitute. I went home to tea, but could eat nothing. I went upstairs and poured out my soul to God, asking for help. I remained long in prayer, but all I could keep saying was, "Lord, help me. Lord, help me." Exactly at 6 o'clock, I called on my friends in the lodge house. They all seemed ready to go. Bill Guest had finished parting his hair. Boswell had fitted on his wooden leg, and not one had shown the white feather. They all laughed at each other and were greatly excited. It was agreed that we should walk down in twos." Can you imagine it? Can you imagine it? "Well, there were. I set off next to the wooden-legged man, and the others followed. All the way we attracted much attention." I'm sure they did. "As I walked on, I could not keep back my tears and kept praying, 'Lord, help me.' When we arrived, others of my contacts were already there, including three well-known characters, Liz Dick, Leech and Sproul. 2 shillings would have been a good price for the wardrobe of all three. They were soon followed by the prodigal son, who had the golly parents, and 4 others. 27 in all. He got them, you see, because he went after them, didn't he? Well, I provided pay hymn books and gave out the page number, but few could find the hymn because they couldn't read, but all pretended to do so. The singing was a disaster, especially as Jenny Lind began to sing before she even knew the tune. Well, I asked them to sit down, and I began to tell them the purpose of my being there. I had in mind, I told them, of my own conversion, of the love of Christ in dying to save sinners from hell and to bring them to heaven. I pointed out the dreadful consequences of despising God's mercy and the misery of a life of sin. I besought them all to seek salvation through the shed blood of Christ. I have spoken to many congregations, but no one more attentive than those 27. Oh, how my soul did yearn in love towards those miserable beings. The young prodigal, wretched son of praying parents, just writhed in an agony of conviction. Others wept, and all were serious. I then proposed prayer and told them that they could stand, sit, or kneel. They all knelt, and ere they rose, the Spirit of God had worked with power. Liz Dick and the old man with the spectacles remained on their knees after the others had risen. They both afterwards confessed that it was years since they had prayed. Another night I preached on the man who had the devils cast out of him. I told them that there were swearing devils, drinking devils, lying devils, thieving devils, filthy devils, Sabbath-breaking devils, idle devils. On asking them which devils they felt they had in them, Liz Dick called out with much feeling, "All of them." 2 dated their conversion to that night: the wooden-legged man and Clough, the donkey cart driver. I received lots of criticism, but I went on. The idle, the dirty, and the miserable came in shoals for advice and also looking for money, which they would. The Chapel for the Destitute, I've seen the Chapel for the Destitute in Rochdale. It's still standing. It's used now as a warehouse, sadly, but I just looked at the door. I imagine Jenny Lind going in, Liz Dick, and the man with the wooden leg, and so just imagine them all going in by the grace of God. The Chapel for the Destitute seated several hundred. Ashworth worked under the following banner: our strength, the grace of God; our rule, the word of God; our object, the glory of God. He says he worked with tramps, beggars, impostors, cripples, gamblers, sick beds, death beds, ruined tradesmen, hopeful cases relapsing, unlikely cases becoming the most promising. They saw real conversions and many showing considerable reformation. Cases of distress, not knowing whether help would be the right thing or not, were his daily burden. One man came pleading for help, as he could no longer do hard work because of affliction. Ashworth bought him a donkey and a cart. In a drunken state, the man sold both donkey and cart, and threatened Ashworth that if he came asking for the money, he would run a knife through him. Not surprising, he wrote in his diary, "A day of sorrow on account of the deep deception and ingratitude of the poor amongst whom I have to labour." As his work increased, he began to receive glowing reports of what he had done. This was to him a matter of the greatest sorrow. He writes, "I find that except I look well to my God, these ovations will rob me of my humility and peace." And another, he writes, "The fuss and ovations I have from day to day, especially in the towns I visit, will ruin my peace with God. Lord, help me to give all the glory to thee." He says of his scripture reader, a lady who worked with him, a scripture reader, she has visited this year 3,171 cases of the poor and the sick, and 26 deathbeds. This visitor is a great help to me, for my rule is not to relieve any case until inquired into, thus saving me from much imposition. of much interest in his publication, My Rugged Friends. Many of the cases contain heart-rending stories of the desperate situation in which people found themselves. Just amazing to read of children and the way they were left by alcoholic parents and left for days and days. And one boy, the story's not here, one boy about 9 or 10. Now he found him, in fact, some woman came to him and said, "I think you better come and see this." And he went to a hovel and there was the boy. No shirt, no covering at all, except his trousers were rolled up, and he was using them as a pillow. Anyway, next time he went to visit him, trousers were gone as well. So he said, "Where's your trousers?" Oh, his mother had taken them to the pawn shop. He went to the pawn shop and got the trousers out, brought them back, and some other clothing for the boy. Next time he visited him, everything was gone again. And these children were just living like this. No benefits, of course. No benefits, no social services. But there's case after case after case. And this godly man went after them. Well, many of the cases contain heart-rending stories of desperate situations in which people found themselves. The report for the year 1865 tells of relief having been given to 4,024 cases, 3,279 in May, 507 in clogs, and 238 in clothing. He writes, "Services at the Chapel for the Destitute continue to be very encouraging. Nowhere do I find a congregation so sincere and attentive. Their love for the plain, simple gospel of Christ is very great. I have not yet been able to get a site for a larger building, but I hope to do so soon." Although the Chapel of the Destitute seated hundreds, he had to get a large building. "Gave 2 shillings to a person who I know was once worth thousands of pounds and moved in the respectable society of the town, but now he is one of the most pitiable objects. Oh, drink, drink, drink has made him a miserable outcast. None of his relations will look at him, but none thinks worse of him than he thinks of himself. He knows that he has wearied them all. Had many poor people at my door today. Fear I am becoming hard-hearted. So many idle, dirty, ragged, drunken people calling on me, at least 100 every week." Imagine that now. Imagine, you know, getting 100 people calling on you every week. I think that's an average of 14 point something a day. Imagine the doorbell going 14 times a day and hopeless cases standing there and you wonder what to do. You know, when we see an occasional beggar comes to the door and so you wonder, don't you now, is this right? He had to do that 14 times a day. Well, in November 1866, he preached in Ashton, and so terrible and dangerous was the crowd that 6 policemen were engaged in controlling the crush. The following year, he was in London, and everyone was going to hear D.L. Moody, but in fact, D.L. Moody went to hear him at St. John's Wood. Moody invited him to America, which he later did. He had a great burden for the correct use of the Lord's Day, and on that day, he would not ride to or from a meeting. He would often go and preach at a place, and the person who was giving hospitality would say, "Well, come on, get in the coach, and the coach and the horse." No. He wouldn't get in. He said that the horse needed its rest as well as everybody else. Well, sometimes he would walk 12 miles to preach, and then he'd walk 12 miles home, but ride he would not. His industry in the work of God was phenomenal. Now, I don't know whether you can cope with this, but you'll have to try. In 1870, the massive social work and the preaching at the chapel for the destitute would have been enough for 2 men, just the work at the chapel, and all the ragtag and bobtail that were coming. But also in the same year, he preached at the following places: Manchester, 15 times, Stockport, Liverpool, Denton, Lee, Sunderland, York, St. Helens, Wigan, Todmorden, Barnsley, Sowerby Bridge, Saltaire, Bradford, London, Milton, Somerset, Ramsbottom, Bury, Bolton, Cottingley, Swansea, Radcliffe, Sheffield, Buxton, Settle, Skipton, Bolton Abbey, Runcorn, Preston, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Rawtenshall, Boynton, Wensleydale, Blackpool, Chesterfield, Wensbury, Dewsbury, Cromford, Matlock, Swinton, Scarborough, Burslem, Oldham, Carlisle, Whitehaven, Southport, Burnley, Louth, Brigg, Birmingham, Norwich, Wisbeach, Saddleworth, Cheltenham, Helmshaw, Hossett, Holywell, Leeds, Huddersfield, and then puts, and etc. And sometimes I think I'm busy. Oh. And of course, alongside these, for instance, you know, he preached a number of times in those places. He was busy, busy, busy. He writes, paid 2 and 6 months for several articles for a poor but interesting girl who was found in a wretched home by one of our visitors. She had been severely scalded in neck and chest whilst asleep on the hearth. She was lying on a little straw on the stone flags with nothing but her own rags of clothing and would certainly have died if we had not got her to the infirmary, where she is doing well. She is without father and would be far better off if she were without mother, a drunken sop. The same month he went to Bristol and there had an interview with George Muller. It is at this time that he witnessed the death of his only daughter, to whom he was greatly attached. She was 24 years of age, he writes, again watched all night. This morning about 3, my dear suffering child spoke her last words to me. She said, God is good. All right, Father, all is right. Jesus is my Jesus. Then she fell asleep, and at 8:30 she breathed her last. Next day he wrote, feel this day dumb before the Lord. Have no words nor any purpose. Helpless, silent and sad, to lose an only daughter, good, affectionate, and who never gave me any trouble. She was converted when she was about 7 years of age, and she had a powerful intellect, and often I have found her counsel valuable. In 1873, he went to the United States, greatly in demand as a preacher in all the areas that he visited. He went to Niagara Falls and on into some of the remotest parts. A train journey took him to the edge of a dense forest. After a further nightmare of a journey through deep woods, he finally arrived at the outpost mission station he was to visit. The elderly missionary welcomed him. Also there was, he describes as, a brawny Red Indian with raven locks, who was introduced to him. To Ashworth's astonishment, the Indian said in reasonable English, I have read all your books, and I have explained them to my fellow Indians. How amazing that his books would have penetrated that dense forest. But God was using this man in an incredible way. Multitudes were coming to Christ, and Christians were catching the vision of evangelism. Well, their books were not only read by the man, the brawny Red Indian with raven locks, but he said they've been read and explained. To find out the source of his amazing industry and powerful work ethic, we must return to the story of his childhood. One day, the minister, in his sermon, used the word prerogative. He asked a man he knew what it meant. No idea, he said. Ask the minister. Oh, that he dared not do. Is there a book that gives the meaning of words? Yes, said somebody. Johnson's Dictionary. But nobody around here has got one. The book traveller may get you one, ask him. So he did. And the book traveller said it would be 2 shillings and 6 months. Well, as a child, he'd never heard of such an amount. The book traveller said, how much will you give a month? With great daring, he said he would give 2 pence a month. But now, where was he to get the 2 pence from? His mother had not one farthing to spare, and he would not ask her. But he would get that first 2 pence somehow. And he made unsuccessful attempts. But there was a woman in our neighbourhood, he said, named Lucy. And sometimes she needed a lad to take her husband his dinner. Why her husband didn't take his own dinner, I don't know, but he didn't. He said, I went to her and said, I will take Jack's dinner 3 times for a halfpenny. Do you young people know what a halfpenny is? Was? Well, a very small amount. Well, I needed 4 halfpennies. I took up that task 4 times. But I had to walk 3 miles there and 3 miles back for a halfpenny. Imagine walking 6 miles for a halfpenny. Anyway, he had to do it 24 miles before he got his 2 pence. Well, then I had to find... Oh, sorry. And with that tuppence, I paid just my first instalment of my first book, Johnson's Dictionary. Then I had to find a further 14 tuppences. But he says, I made a bargain with myself that I would never pass a word that I did not understand without consulting that book. And it was in that way I soon acquired knowledge of the meaning of words. He got his 2 shillings and 6 pence. He bought Johnson's Dictionary. Many years later, when he began writing the stories of the great works of God in saving many from the gutter and them being brought to Christ, he wondered how he would get these stories printed. He took it to the printer and was told that it would cost £100. But it was impossible for him to find such an amount, and greatly downcast and gloomy, he made his way home determined to give up the whole business of trying to print his works. Well, he was walking home, and a friend, Mr. Petrie, met him and asked him the cause of his sorrow. So we told him. Petrie said, well, if you agree to give me half of the profit, should there be any, I'll give you the £100. And God in his providence was meeting him all the time. Back he went to the printer, and the first book was prepared. 18 months later, Ashworth appeared at Petrie's door with the first £30 he had gained from the selling of his book. Petrie wouldn't take a penny of it. There are now 5 books giving accounts of the marvellous works of God. They're all out of print, apart from this one, which I will mention shortly. One was presented to Queen Victoria. Within Ashworth's own lifetime, imagine this, you know, 1850, 1860, within Ashworth's own lifetime, 3 million of these tales had been circulated and had been printed into 7 different languages. How incredible. Here he is, this barefooted, ragged little boy. Who would have guessed what God would do? Well, the conversions were so dramatic that many refused to believe that they had ever happened. One loudly denied such a thing could ever have happened to Niff. Niff's one of the stories in this book, Niff and His Dogs. Wonderful, wonderful story. Oh, the power of God to save sinners. Well, Niff went and presented himself to the man to demonstrate the power of gospel conversion. Niff said in his 82nd year, he believed God had spared him so long in order that people could look at him and see what God's saving grace could do. Ashworth received hundreds of letters telling of the good resulting from his writings. They told of many conversions, many prodigals returned, and many of God's people led to seek after the outcast and the wanderers and to open other chapels for the destitute in different towns and cities in our country. And also in other countries, chapels for the destitute were built and were taken, probably took over some building. And away they went after the outcast. Now, to show that there was no perfection in John Ashworth, that he had feet of clay, I will read a story. There was a great desire in Ashworth and other men in Rochdale for a special work of God to begin in the town. They heard about an American evangelist and the work he was doing in many English towns and cities and wondered if they could persuade him to visit Rochdale. Ashworth and another man were sent to see him. And Ashworth writes, being shown into the library of the house where he was staying, the evangelist made his appearance. After a mutual introduction, we all sat down. What is your errand, gentlemen? He asked. We come from Rochdale, we replied, and the friends there would like you to come and preach for a few nights. We have a very large chapel, and no doubt it will be crowded to hear you. The evangelist said, the people of Manchester have asked me to preach there for the same 3 nights, and obviously I cannot be at both. We understand you are wanted there, they said, but we wondered if you would give us the preference. Let us kneel down and pray, said the evangelist. Well, he began first as follows. Lord, here are 2 selfish men come from Rochdale. They say they know that I am requested to preach at Manchester, but they want me to give that up and go to Rochdale in preference. They care nothing about Manchester souls, but only Rochdale souls. Lord, teach these two men that souls are souls, all equal in value everywhere. Then laying his hand on my shoulder, he said, "Now you pray, brother." What I said, I cannot tell, but I know I was very brief. Then he laid his hand on my friend and he said, "Now you pray, brother." He was equally brief. We arose from our knees with no little confusion. Needless to say, the evangelist never visited Rochdale. In 1874, Ashworth's health began to fail. To an unskilled person, he looked comparatively well. But on a visit to London, the keen eye of C.H. Spurgeon, who he was visiting, could detect it at once. And looking him in the face, he said, "Brother, you are ill, and you need to rest." He worked on during that summer, but with increasing bouts of weakness. When in letters to him, friends would flatter him for the work, he would say, "Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to thy cross I cling." Early in 1875, it was clear he had not long in this life. And on the 26th of January, 1875, he was called home to the God he had served so faithfully. He was 61 years of age. There are some modern books brought out. They're old prints, really. But this really is the one that covers most ground. And I've got some with me tonight. And if you would like to read, and I trust you would, further of this man, here is the book to read. There are no big words. I took this book up in our daughter's home, and I discovered, not this one, but the one I've got at home, I discovered that it was a Sunday school prize for him. So you see how simple it is. Mind you, they used to give prizes in those days that were good. And it opens, you see. It's a hardback book, but it opens. It's not one of these books that you've got to sort of, you're frightened of breaking the back. No, it opens and it's all here. Now, when I got this book and I read it, I said, this has got to be reprinted. What a shame it is that nobody can read this book. So I went to my good friend Phil Roberts and I said, "Phil, you've got to print this book. It's got to be redone, you see." So anyway, Phil said, "All right." He said, "Well, 100, I've got to print 100. Well, I said, "I'd not be able to sell 100. I said, couldn't you do me half a dozen? "Oh, no, he said, "Can't do that. You've got to have 100. So anyway, I went to a meeting and Phil had the books. I said, in faith, I said, I'll have the 100. So I was at a meeting and he was there and he gave the box of books, a few boxes. I turned around and Dave Humphreys, some of you will know, was standing behind me. I said, "Dave, you've got to get one of these books, definitely." So anyway, Dave said, "Yeah, all right, I'll take it." That was the first book that I sold. And I went around churches and just was telling them really a little about what went on. And I began to dig into the 100. And I went, and then I had to go to Phil and said, "Phil, could you do me another 100? And so he printed a second 100. And I kept going on and selling the books. Up to now, I've sold 917 of these Ashworth books. Quite incredible. There's no mention of denomination. I think it's right. And there's no mention of any denomination. He doesn't prompt that. His theology might be a little different to some of ours, like John Wesley's would. But here it is. Now, if you want to buy one in the shop, if you can find one in the shop, they are £13.95. If you buy one from me, they're £8.95. Hardback, £8.95. You've got friends that need a book because their birthday is coming up. Christmas is not far away. And you could buy somebody a good blessing. Stories like Niff and His Dogs and incredible, just amazing works of God's grace. All to the glory of God. Now, there's no profit for me. If I sell it to you for £8.50, £8.50 goes to Phil Roberts. And so I've sold 917, but not gained a penny. So I'm not here on some profit-making engagement. If you want a book, you don't need any money tonight. You don't need any money, but we'll get it from you in due course. If you have got the money and you want a book, give it to my wife. I give all my money to my wife, and you follow my example. And I've got a dozen, or maybe 13. If one person wants 15 books, well, I can get you those. But I know some of you have got this book. If you have got it and you haven't read it, get down to it, because it'll do your soul good. Now, if I can make a suggestion, and one or two people have followed me up on this, if you begin at the chapter My New Friends, that's where he begins the work of the Chapel for the Destitute. There are two early chapters, I think there are two, and they don't really get the book off to the best start. They should be read at the end. And if I had more time and energy, I would have put the last two chapters at the end. If you begin My New Friends, and you read about the man with the wooden leg and Jenny Lind and all them, you'll be able to read them to children. Stories in here that you can read to children and show children the great works of God. And we know a man, he's a plumber, and his mother went to visit him. When he opened the door, he was in tears. Oh, she thought there's some problem here in the family. What's going to happen? He said, "You've got to read this, look at this." And he showed her some pages he was reading in this book. Vernon Higham in Cardiff, his wife is almost blind. Vernon's gone to heaven, but somebody has been going on Wednesday afternoons to read a chapter to Mrs. Higham. Well, there are blessings, and we praise God for all his gracious goodness, and just trust God that there may be a raising up of others who will set us the example, and that we too may have a burden for souls. Thank you.